Mini episode 156 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 156 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris with you here today. We've got, once again, a very special FDH Lounge mini episode for you. This should be a tremendous segment. Many thanks to our senior producer, Steve Servillo, for getting this one booked. This will be the fourth gentleman that we have had on from the band Journey. And that's including the all-time roster, by the way, because as you go back through the history of the band, the gentleman today is the only one of the four still playing with the band and one of the original co-founders of Journey. So he goes way back. He spent a little bit of time outside of the band in the later 80s and into the 90s, but is back playing with them. And this is the fourth gentleman that we've had from the band on the program. The most recent one that we did last fall was with Steve Perry. Prior to that, Greg Rowley, and then Steve Smith. So working our way through the band, working our way through, I guess you could say, a lot of the different roles that have been played in the band over a period of time. And this gentleman, as we said, also has done a number of other projects over a period of time that are very interesting as well. We speak, of course, of Ross Valerie. We're very pleased to welcome him to the FDH Lounge for FDH Lounge mini episode 156. Ross, welcome to the program, sir. Pleasure to have you on today.
Hello.
Oh, very, very happy to do this. And again, it's been just a pleasure to learn so much about the great Journey band over a period of time. And I'm sure this will just add to the understanding that all the folks have about the band. Let's start chronologically here as far as the origins. I know that you'd had some other projects going on previous to that, and I always have to just admire what a tremendous name this was. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Freemius Bandersnatch as a band that you were in prior to that. But talk, if you would, about the Northern California music scene that you were in and what some of the events were that led up to forming Journey.
Well, yeah, for me, having grown up in the San Francisco Bay Area, I was just graduating in time at the end of the 60s to take part and be a part with the San Francisco music scene as it was growing and burgeoning and bursting forth. There was a lot of activity, as people well know, at that time in San Francisco. It's where a lot of bands were forming. It's where a lot of bands ended up going, where a lot of single artists and writers came to San Francisco to add to it, to draw from the energy that was going on then. So having grown up there, I formed in a group called Freemius Bandersnatch, which was a second bill act, along with other acts like the Santana Blues Band. We would be the second bill act at all the locations there, Fillmore, Avalon, et cetera, et cetera. And then Freemius Bandersnatch disbanded in one way over a year, like 1969. And slowly but surely, most of the members of the band filtered into the Steve Miller Band. Of course, Steve Miller had been there with the Steve Miller Blues Band at the peak of the San Francisco music scene. And most of his original members had moved on to other projects, and he began bringing in members of Freemius Bandersnatch. We were big fans of his music, and so it was a natural thing. I worked with Steve from 1970 to the second half of 71. It was during a point in his career in which it was in between the Steve Miller Blues Band and what would become, you know, famous for the Joker and all that. That was that area in between. We recorded an album with him called Rock Love. And then I left Steve Miller, and that's about the point where a common friend and manager in the industry, Herbie Herbert, introduced me and Neil Sean and Greg Raleigh, who had just left Santana, and that's the beginning of the Journey project in late 72, early 73.
It's a very interesting thing, Ross, in terms of the history of it, because, again, and you just mentioned the name and one of our past guests on the program, Greg Raleigh, and we talked to him when he was on. Now, we talked a little bit about his time with Santana as well as Journey, but that's
right.
Really something that you have in common with him as far as your tenure with the Steve Miller Band also, really. I mean, both of you being a part of two Hall of Fame caliber bands over the course of your career, not just one.
Yes, yes. And Greg had left Santana, and I left Miller, and Neil was right there at that point, too. So it was an introduction that's kind of interesting because the idea that was in mind, that Herbie had in mind, was to put these guys together and form a rhythm section, unlike Muscle Shoals rhythm section or something like that, a band of caliber players who would be available to work with any artist that came through. So that idea quickly, though, changed, and let's form our own band, which we did, and as a result, with Neil and Greg Raleigh and Ainsley Dunbar, and with George Tickner, the other guitarist writer, we formed a band, and we're actually performing two or more years before we actually released our first album on CBS in 1975. We were actually playing in cities like Chicago, Detroit, and of course San Francisco, other places before we had an album. At that time, in that era, there was a phenomenon called supergroups, in which known players from various groups would get together and had the credibility and the availability as well to go out and play and record. So we were fortunate in that market and in that time period to go out and play even before we released an album. And of course, we did eventually sign with CBS and put out our first three records, 75, 76, and 77. They were entitled Journey, Looking at the Future, and Next, which brought us to a point in around 1978 in which the record company was wanting to hear and display a band that was more song-oriented. The first Journey was more experimental and odd-time signatures, and we there were vocally-oriented songs, but mostly instrumental and experimental, and the company wanted to hear a song. So that's when we began focusing more on the vocal songwriting end of it, and that was how Steve Perry came to the forefront.
Well, that's interesting, Ross, that you're mentioning some of the commercial considerations there, because that was what I was going to ask you about next. As a lifelong resident of Cleveland and somebody that grew up on MMS, I'm always curious to know, as far as bands like yours, when you're coming up, obviously it was a different time in the 70s as far as airplay and everything right now, which is so under the thumb of corporate control. But as you were getting the first couple of albums out there with stations like MMS and some of the more cutting-edge ones across the country, what was the progression like for you as far as radio helping you build a following?
Well, in those days, there were actually, independent and independently thinking radio stations. There was really radio. There were people that were called program directors, and they would decide either for the events of the day with different disc jockeys, or the disc jockeys themselves would decide what they were going to play that day. And of course, that whole approach to radio airplay has long disappeared. We had the support, as you mentioned, of stations like MMS and others all over the Midwest and the South and the West, and then built into the East Coast. But we had a great amount of support there. And the ironic thing, connecting that thought with what I was talking about, what the record company expected, there's something interesting and ironic about it, because it wasn't as though the band was not selling well with its original format, musical format. We actually did very well. We went gold, which is 500,000 copies per album, and that was no sharp stick in the eye. That was a very good turnout and a very successful result for those three albums. But nonetheless, the record company thought that they could ask for more and get more. So that's what was the transition. And of course, as we did that, other bands were coming up strong with the same kind of approach that we had, like Yes and Rush. It's almost as though Journey was too far ahead of its time for that original format of music. But we moved on and obviously did something very different and have succeeded at that with the advent of Steve Perry. And as we continue today, having drawn upon so many hit songs that are still being played on the radio, end quote, because radio's a lot different now. It's all pre-digested. Yeah. You know, and you can't, you know, and the other ironic thing for us is as we've released albums in the late 90s and in this century, we put out several albums, some of which have done well, like Revelation did very well. And of course, the release of our Live in Manila DVD with Arnel Panetta did well. But there's other albums that just haven't done anything because there is no format out there, let alone enough true open channel radio to take a band who's a classic band and has classic hits. There's no format to put out new material by a band who's classic. So it's been interesting and challenging to get new songs on the air. In some cases we succeeded. We got some good results from Revelation and, we had some good results, of course, from Trial by Fire, which was the last project with Steve Perry in 1996. But it's a whole new ballgame out there. But as we have learned well, that as we perform, and which performance is our mainstay, we make sure that we cover the songs that people want to hear. We do introduce at every concert later material, newer material, so to speak. But the mainstay is to play the songs that people want to hear. So we're fortunate in that regard. We have a lot of them that they know, and we come away from the stage with everyone happy.
Absolutely. I would think that's all that the fans could ask for. Obviously, there's going to be some newer material in there, but they want to hear the classics also. And if you can mix them together, I'm sure that's what makes people happy. When you're talking about the albums that people would regard as the Journey heyday, the era of albums,
yes,
like Frontiers and Escape, it's
right.
Interesting. I want to compare notes on this with you, Ross, in talking with some of your bandmates. And we had on Christopher Cross a few months back, and I asked him about this as well. Coincidentally, that was right about his height also when those albums were out. This whole concept that the public has of mailbox money, of residuals, you know, you guys had the Journey Escape video game, which I ain't going to lie, as a kid, I was playing that thing a lot. So I know the public probably has this image of residuals that are just never ending. And, you know, you guys had the big hits from back in the day. But one by one, in posing the question, I have found out that ain't necessarily so. So is that something that you would agree with also, that what the public tends to think of as far as residuals and everything that continues to come in is probably overblown in their mind?
Well, it's not overblown at all. And royalty income or mailbox money, as you call it, is a reality for this band. And as the songs remain on the radio, the results are the same with the mailbox. And it goes up and down, but generally we've had some great bursts in income that way. In that, as the band performs, and as subsequent re-releases of Greatest Hits and Greatest Hits Live are, you know, currently out there, it does boost it in the sales. But most of all, I think the reason why we have some good success there is given when the band went away, the band sort of disappeared for 8 years or so from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. Fortunately, the efforts of management and the efforts of the record company kept those songs on the air, and they continued to refashion and repackage other performances, whether live or other compilations of hits, which helped bolster that. So I can't say that I'm disagreeing with other people in the band, but mailbox money is significant, and it tends to grow well. The catalog is strong as long as it's being promoted, which is what we've been doing as a reformed band since 1998.
Sure. Well, you know, hey, God bless you if it's continuing to come in like that. And it's funny, I go back, I think it was about 4 years ago, when Steve Smith was on with us. He was the first of your bandmates that was on. And I remember at the time, yeah, his take on it was a little bit different. So either you guys have really moved a lot of units in the last 4 years, or maybe you got a better agent than he does, or maybe your perspective is just a little different. It's interesting.
Yeah, Steve Smith is a partner in our publishing and in our writer's royalty. And it does fluctuate. But, Steve, as well as the rest of us, do not or cannot necessarily depend on mailbox money alone. Steve's career as a jazz musician and as a clinician, he does a lot of drum clinics. He travels the world. That's more what he relies on. And, of course, if any one of us or all of us are smart, we learn how to save our money and invest it well, or at least not go into high-risk areas. But for Steve Smith, it's his jazz career that I think he relies on initially. And for us, it's performance and merchandising, which is what we rely on from year to year to really make the substantial income. So it's a balance between a consistent catalog income, but mostly going out there and working, going out there and performing, selling tickets. So.
Interesting. Yeah, it's always really intriguing to get a glimpse at how the industry functions and how bands like yours that hit the heights that they have over a period of time, what the formula is for that process going forward. And again, as you said, you're out there on the road. You've got a tour going on right now. Obviously, I mean, that continues to goose it as it goes along. And that has to be something that's very critical to sustaining the interest in the band, and one would think also introducing it to new generations as well.
Yes, exactly. And New Generations, Generations was an album that we recorded just a few years ago, and it reflected in a theme the longstanding tradition where Journey fans pass their enthusiasm for the band onto their children. And then onto their children. So there is a substantial portion of our audience at the shows who are generational, just absolutely generational. But there's also with the influx of things like Glee and Rock of Ages and the other uses of our hits in television or in movies, or that has introduced a separate demographic of fans. In the last few years, we've been seeing teenagers in the front row who are like just discovering us. You know, it's like, whoa, you dudes rock. You know, we're seeing that there is an introduction to a new part of the public that was not aware of it before. So some of the younger people, the kids and teenagers are discovering it. It's a retro thing for them. And of course there's school kids who sing Don't Stop Believing because of its exposure as the most downloaded song in history for some reason. That's wonderful. So even school kids are singing it, you know. They're well familiar with it because of its exposure on television and elsewhere. So that's a new thing to us, beyond the generational traditional part of the public that's always been there because they were listening long ago and still are.
Ross, thank you very much, sir. And I want to plug also mouthman.com. I know you've got the children's clothing line there as well. Thank you so
that's
much,
right.
Ross.
Yeah, mouthman.com, the shirt that comes alive. Yeah, you enjoy it. Us big kids enjoy it, and the kids will enjoy it too. Thanks for that plug, Rick.
No problem. Ross, I hope to do it again sometime soon. Thank you, sir. Excellent having with us today the great Ross Valerie from Journey.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.